Les colloques du Collège de France.
Très bien, nous allons reprendre la session après une pause qui a été un peu plus longue que prévu, mais qui a permis des discussions informelles, ce qui est également important dans une journée de colloque. Et nous allons donc poursuivre cette matinée avec une présentation qui va concerner les manuscrits du Caucase. Et je voudrais donc donner la parole à Jost Gippert, qui est un spécialiste des langues du Caucase, bien connu comme professeur de linguistique comparée à l'université de Francfort, qui est aujourd'hui à Hambourg, dans le Centre des cultures manuscrites, qui est, comme vous le savez, l'un des centres majeurs au monde d'études des manuscrits dans toutes sortes de langues. Et il est à la tête du projet ERC DELICATE, qui est l'acronyme pour The Development of Literary in the Caucasian Territories. Il s'est très tôt intéressé non seulement à la linguistique, mais également aux manuscrits du Caucase, et notamment à l'analyse électronique des manuscrits. Et il a participé au gros volume que beaucoup d'entre vous connaissent sans doute, consacré aux études comparatives des manuscrits orientaux, qui est disponible d'ailleurs sur le site de Hambourg. Et il a également publié en collaboration des études sur les manuscrits albaniens du Caucase. Et c'est le thème dont il va nous entretenir aujourd'hui, avec une communication intitulée « Paratexts in the Caucasian Albanian Palimpsests of Mount Sinai, Forms and Functions ».
Oui, merci au Collège de France et merci aux organisateurs de ce colloque très remarquable de m'avoir invité. J'espère que ma voix sera suffisante pour la demi-heure aujourd'hui parce que j'ai perdu un peu de voix. Je vais parler en anglais, simplement, autrement ça durerait encore une heure de plus. I will be talking about paratexts in the Caucasian Albanian palimpsest of Mount Sinai, form and functions. And this is what I will be talking about. I will shortly introduce the Albanian palimpsests and their structure. They consist of three parts, namely parts which I call GM, LM1 and LM2. I will explain what it means. I will talk about the types of paratexts that we find in them, their arrangement, their forms and functions, which depend very much on the main text type. And finally, I will draw some conclusions. You all will know the famous monastery of St. Catherine's on Mount Sinai. In 1975, there was an accident with a big fire, and this fire was very, very helpful for all kinds of investigations into ancient texts of that region, because it revealed, among others, also the only existing manuscript remains of a language that we call Caucasian Albanian, which has nothing to do with the Albanian spoken on the Balkans. It's simply an adaptation of the Greek term that was used for that people in the southern Caucasus. The Albanian manuscript remains are all palimpsests, and they are all overwritten by Georgian in about the 10th, 11th century. And here you see a typical double page. And if you look into the fold between the two pages, then you can see that there is something written that looks a bit like Armenian or Georgian, but it's neither the one nor the other. It's Caucasian Albanian. Here you can see it a bit more exactly. Now, as I said, these palimpsests consist of three parts, all in all 176 folios, 46 are missing. The first part, which I call GM, is a gospel manuscript consisting only of the Gospel of John. It must have consisted of six quires, but parts of it only has survived. But we can be sure that this was a complete Gospel of John. The second part is a lectionary with texts from the Apostolos, Epistles, Acts, and also one OT lection. It consists of three quires all in all, but here too we have many gaps. And in the third part, this is also a lectionary, but this time a gospel lectionary with texts from the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, and Luke, not from John, because this is already covered by the gospel manuscripts. So this is the way how we can today reconstruct the original codices that are behind that. In the edition, the first edition that we undertook and that was published in 2008, this was still a bit more more or less uncertain, and now we can be much more certain because we have much better images now thanks to the so-called Sinai Palimpsest project, and I will show you some of them. So this is the reconstruction of the six choirs of the Gospel of John. And this is the reconstruction of the five choirs of the two lectionary parts. You can see anything that is with a gray background can be reconstructed, but is not present. We don't have those folios. Here you have the first impression of how the Gospel of John might have looked like. These are pseudo-color images that were produced by the Sinai Palimpsest project, and they try to bring up a bigger contrast between the original script, the upper script, and the background. So these are all wrong colors, but the reddish color is the one that represents the original text. And you can see it's not very well readable. This part is much better readable. It's from the first lectionary part, and this is from the second lectionary part, even better readable. Now, if we compare the three hands, then we can see that these are actually three different original manuscripts. They were not written by the same hand, not even the two lectionary parts, which we still assume to be one lectionary in 2008. The general structure of the original manuscripts as we can reconstruct them today is equal across the three parts, in consisting of two columns each, with enlarged initials and also with marginal paratexts. The specific differences between GM and the others are the Gospel manuscript has 21 lines per column, the lectionary parts have 22 to 23 lines per column, and only in the lectionary part we also have what I call inline paratexts. Now let's have a look at the paratexts that we actually find. I begin with the Apostolos lectionary LM1 because this contains most of them. And this is a typical page where you have two columns, as you can see. The main text in the left-hand column is from the second letter to Timothy, and on the right-hand side in the second column, there is the beginning of another lection from the first letter to Timothy. In between, you can see there are... How do I use this? Yeah, you have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 lines written in smaller characters. If you compare this across, then you can see these are much bigger than these. And here you have sometimes very, very high initial letters. And these six lines in between are paratexts, as I will show you. And there is another paratext written between the two columns, which is this one, written in even smaller characters. So, the six lines first indicate the occasion or purpose of the lection. This is a lection for a feast of the cross and churches. That means probably for the middle of September. Then comes an introductory psalm or antiphon, which is Psalm 25:8. Begins here. And then we have a lection title, which says the following is from the first letter to Timothy by Paul. This is these three lines, and this is an exceptional way of putting information as to the following lection in line between the two lections. In the middle, as you have seen, there is this extra gloss, and this gloss indicates the same thing again, namely the occasion, the purpose is a lection at a feast of churches. It's not just the same, there is a small difference, and this might be indicative of two different hands or two different people working on this. Now, as I said, this is a bit exceptional, because normally what we have in line between two lections is written in very small characters with these high initials, but it's only the title of the following lection. So here we have the title of 1 Corinthians, and the following lection is 1 Corinthians 15, 51 to 58. And The other elements are written in the interlinear or intermarginal, intercolumnary glosses, and here this indicates that this is a lection for saints and martyrs. Similarly, here we have the indication, the following lection is from 1 Thessalonians, actually 2:5-12, and in the gloss we have the indication that this is a lection for apostles. Now, this is all information that is usual for a lectionary, of course. We also have some different indications in the margins, namely, for example, section numbers. Here we have the section number 12, marking the beginning of Romans 8:18. And in some cases, we have a numbering of verses across the Pauline epistles. This, for example, is the indication of verse number 250, which equals the middle of Ephesians 5:29. And the interesting thing is that the word for verses that is used here is the word houses. And this is exactly the same way as the same information would have been given in Armenian, where the word for verses used is the same word as the word for house. Sometimes the section numbers seem to be combined with a gloss, like here, where we have section number 17. You see this is encircled by some lines. This is the beginning of Hebrews 12:1, and below it says that this is a lection for saints and the 40 martyrs. But in some cases, we can see that this is just by accident. So the section number does not belong to the gloss and is not necessarily part of it. Here, for example, we have the gloss that this is a lection for kings, arranged with the title of 1 Timothy again. And then this is at the end of the left column of a page. And the beginning of the right column of the page is the beginning of 1 Timothy 2:1. And here you have the section number 4 for this lection. So they have a system of numbering not only for the Gospels, but also for the Pauline epistles. In one case, the gloss contains not only the purpose, namely here four entreaties, combined with the title of Ephesians again, but also an additional psalm, Psalm Antiphon 66:2. You remember that the first example that I showed you also contained a psalm in between, so in some cases the lections from the Apostolos are combined with psalm antiphons. And also the only one lection from the Old Testament that we have in this lectionary is also marked with a gloss indicating that this is a lection for the blind and weakened, combined with the title of Isaiah, and the lection actually is Isaiah 35:3-8. Then we have something peculiar in two versions also in this part of the lectionary, namely psalm lists. This is the end of the lection of Isaiah, and after it you can see there are lots of lines in those smaller characters, and they simply provide a list of psalms. And you can see that most of the psalms are indicated with their purpose. This, for example, is a psalm that was sung for the Feast of Churches, and this is Psalm 25:8, which we've already seen. In one case, the last case, it's not certain which psalm we have, but I am quite sure now that this is Psalm 24:16. Now, the second psalm list is terrible. Why? Because, unfortunately, just the left half of this folio was burnt. As I told you, the palimpsests were found in the fire, and of course the fire was extinguished, but many of the folios were very badly burnt, and in two cases this is really dramatic. This is one of the two dramatic cases. You can see that of the first column we only have the last two, three or four characters here, but they are all in the minor sized characters. At the end here, this is the beginning of a new main text, namely 1 Corinthians 12, 26. And before, we can easily restore this as being the title of 1 Corinthians. And here before, we can assume different psalms, again, because of the size and the arrangement. And if we look into a neighboring tradition, in this case, the Armenian one, this is the famous lectionary here of Paris, number 44. We can see that the lection of 1 Corinthians 12:26 following is combined with Psalm 18:5. And this works perfectly well with what we have here as remnants of the two lines before. So we can assume that this was the same psalm. You can also see that in this beautiful Armenian lectionary manuscript, you have the same arrangement. The main text is written in normal, thick majuscules, but the lines in between, which are the paratexts, they are written in a minor majuscule. Not in a minuscule, but a minor majuscule. And similarly, we also can use the Georgian tradition for comparison, where, for example, we have lists of psalms that are quite similar to what we find in the Albanian palimpsests. This is one list of psalms, namely psalms that were used in the common services for apostles. And here, for example, you have the same Psalm 18:5 mentioned. And this is a longer one, which is from the common services for martyrs. And here, for example, you find Psalm 115:6, another one that we can make out in the Albanian palimpsest. So finally, we can reconstruct this psalm list with all the ingredients. But I have to go back to the Georgian again. And the Georgian is very peculiar because for every single psalm or antiphon, it gives the mode in which they were sung. You can see, You can see the third mode, fourth mode plagal, fourth mode plagal, fourth mode, etc. And we can now assume that also in the Albanian, there was an indication of the mode sung. This would bring the Albanian tradition very much closer to the Georgian than to the Armenian, because in the Armenian, I haven't found this type of information in the lectionaries yet. Okay, let's go on to the Gospel lectionary. This is the beginning of one lection from Matthew, Matthew 10:16 to 22, and you have the title written in minor majuscules in this first line. In this case, it's even written beyond the beyond the page, so to say. So it's in line number zero, as if in the upper margin. And then we have two glosses in the margin, in the left margin, one indicating the purpose for saints and martyrs, and the other one indicating a psalm, Alleluia, Psalm 31:1. So we have a similar system here. Purpose and psalm, in another example, you have here for the gospel lection for transfiguration, which is Matthew 17:1 following. The title is written beginning here, and this is the initial character of Matthew 17. And here again, you have a longer Alleluia psalm indicated, Psalm 41:7. Of course, in the Gospel lectionary, there are also section numbers, namely the Eusebian section numbers of which we have heard today. This is really the Eusebian ones and not others. For example, section number 199 indicates the beginning of Matthew 19:30. Then comes the title indicating that the following is also from the Gospel of Matthew, and then the purpose is indicated here in the marginal gloss. It's a gospel lection for Paul, and the lection actually is Matthew 21:16. Another example is this one, Matthew 23:34, is introduced by the purpose gospel lection of prophets and Zechariah, and here you have the section number 240. Here we have everything practically together, namely, first of all, a gospel purpose is indicated here, the gospel for prophets. Then we have indicated the beginning of or the title of the gospel lection from Luke. Then we have a section number 22, which is Luke 4:25, and then we have an Alleluia psalm. In this case, this is the only one that is not really identified. It's either Psalm 23.7 or 0.9, but they are identical in their incipits, and so I cannot tell. So there are still some special paratexts in the lectionary part. This is the most important page for this. Again, a page that was badly burned. As you can see, the left column only consists of the last characters. It contains Romans 8, 9 to 27. But if you look at the top of the page, then you can see there is one line written along and across the two columns, and there is one extra character written just in the middle. So there is a text line and a character, which can always be a number, and if it's a number, then it's number 7. This is how the text line can be restored, and this has been quite known already in 2008, but now we can get a bit beyond this. Namely, again, by comparing the neighboring traditions. This is the initial page of the famous Armenian lectionary here in Paris. And on the left-hand side, you can see that, again, we have a nice image of two columns. And this is the beginning. There is nothing on the back side. And the beginning says that this is a memorial volume of the synaxes that are performed in Jerusalem. Yes, we know this is the lectionary of the Jerusalem Rite. And the same is true for the Albanian. This is also present in another nice Armenian lectionary manuscripts of the Vatican Library, here on page 80 recto, memorial volume of the synaxes, etc. And we have the same information also in the Georgian tradition, because this also depends on the Jerusalem Rite. Here, for example, the famous Latal lectionary says this is the determination and ordinance by the Orthodox leaders, which they perform or do in Jerusalem. Same in one manuscript of Mount Sinai, Georgian 37. And in the famous Georgian lectionary of Paris, Georgian 3, it's also said clearly that this is arranged according to the rite of the holy city of Jerusalem. So we can now reconstruct this line as meaning these are collections of commemorations that are performed all the time in Jerusalem. This is exactly the same information as the one transported by the Armenian and the Georgian neighbors. Now, what then is the number 7 below? This is clear from another page. This is the second choir, the beginning of the second choir of the lectionary part. And this contains, at the same position, another number, namely number 8. So if this is 8, and the other one is 7, and the other one is the first page of the lectionary part, this means that this was the beginning of the lectionary part, but it was added to the Gospel of John, because the Gospel of John consisted of 6 choirs. So they were put together as one codex. So we can summarize for LM1 and LM2. First, that the paratexts in the upper margins comprise the general header, and this is actually an important paratext, I would say, and the choir numbers, which are very important for us because they determine the structure of the original codex. The inline paratexts comprise titles of lections, the psalm lists, and exceptionally also once the occasion or purpose and the psalm antiphon. The other paratexts, arranged as glosses, comprise the occasion or purpose of lections, psalms antiphons or alleluia psalms, and section numbers. Now let's go to the Gospel of John, the first part of the reconstructed codex. As I told you, it's not very well readable, and Actually, in the edition of 2008, we were not able to read more than maybe 25% of it. With the new images that we now have, we arrived by 55-60%, which is very much more and very much clearer. Anyway, it's not easy to read in this form, but in this form you can see at least where the lines are and where the characters are. This is the so-called transmissive light imaging, a technique that was invented during the Sinai Palimpsest project, and I'm really very grateful for our colleagues who did this and who provided these images. Now, on the same page, in the lower margin, there are some elements that you can read better in the pseudo-color image, namely very little elements written here and here and here and here. These are all below the main text, and this is in the left margin. What we have here is clearly, on the one hand, section numbers. This is section number 138. And then below the main text, we have the Eusebian apparatus, which is, so to say, the shortened form of what Martin Wallraff presented in the morning. Namely, the arrangement of sections from the Gospel of John compared with sections from the other three Gospels. And here in the apparatus we can make out John 136, 37, 38, equaling Matthew 204 and Mark 125. This was the left column. Under the right column, we have the continuation. First of all, here is the section number 141 for the text, and here is the apparatus, and you see John 139, 140, 141, and then Matthew 90 and Mark 139. Here, this is a nicer example where you can read the numbers very well. These are numbers 148 and 149, and here you have Matthew 111, and here you have Mark 119. This is an error. It's written clearly that this is from Mark, but actually it's Luke 119. So somebody who copied this, we had the question in the morning, but somebody who copied this was not aware of all these numbers, whether they were correctly assigned or not. In some very few cases, in the Gospel of John, we have some liturgical glosses too. This is one of them, and it says this is for the sake of the deceased, and it indicates the beginning of John 5:19 to 23 or further on, which is also a lection for the dead in other traditions. Or this one, John 12:24, is glossed as of Stephen. And this means this is about the proto-martyr, and it's also used as a lection in many other traditions. In some cases, also very few, we have glosses indicating textual variants. This is true for John 6:42, where we have two such glosses. This is a gloss simply meaning Jesus, and this is a gloss that simply means mother. And this is to be inserted here, and here you see the obelisk type signs here, which say that in the sentence, isn't this the son of Joseph? In some cases, people would have, isn't this Jesus, the son of Joseph? And it continues, of whom we know the Father, and some traditions say, of whom we know the Father and Mother. So they used this in order to indicate there are variants, and you will find exactly the same two glosses also, for example, in the Armenian traditions at the same place. And this is also true for the very few explanatory glosses that we have. In two cases, the word for Easter appearing in the text of John is glossed by the word pasek, which is actually the word pascha. So for Easter, the word used in the text is achsibai, which is, interestingly enough, a Georgian loanword for Easter. And then the outer text, the gloss, indicates that this can also be called pascha. And again, you will find exactly the same or a similar gloss in both the Armenian and the Georgian traditions. So this was something going on in the Caucasus. The last paratext that we have in the Gospel of John is unfortunately again burnt off. It's the right column of this double page. Here you can see a few characters, but this is all what we have. And this is very bad, because this was obviously a colophon telling us who wrote the Gospel of John and when and where. What we can make out is the first word. This is Zu, which means I. Okay, we would expect the name and then something else about the person. Second line might have meant something like, by the mercy of God. Yes, fine. And then again, Zu in the fourth line, I did something. And then this is all, can be anything. And then comes my father and mother and my relatives. Yes, of course, this is the typical way of trying to have a benefit for the own family. And at the end, it seems to mean so that a candle can be lit for Mary or something like this. So it's not very telling. What we actually would need is the part that is missing here. So whenever you go to Mount Sinai, try to find, please, this missing part. For the Gospel of John, I can give the following summary. The paratext in the lower margins, of course, comprised the Eusebian apparatus. Whether this was applied regularly or not is very difficult to tell, because they are rarely discernible in those images. The other paratexts comprise the Ammonian section numbers. These were obviously applied regularly. Then the colophon and liturgical indications in five cases. We have the indications of textual variants in two cases and the indications of explanations or maybe lexical variants in also two cases. This is all what we have. And, I'm going backwards. And this leads me to the following conclusion. Except for the section numbers and a few indications of liturgical purposes, paratexts in the Gospel of John and the lectionary parts of the palimpsest do not have very much in common. In the lectionary parts, they are, in my view, integral elements of the text. This is always a question of relative relation between text, main text, or what we call main text, and paratext. In a lectionary, if you take the Bible text as the main text, then of course they are additional. But if you take the lectionary as a lectionary, then they are an integral part and you cannot get rid of them. So a lectionary without the indication of purposes, without the indication of titles, and also without the indication of psalms to be sung in between, is not a lectionary. So this, I would say, is why I would not call them paratexts in the sense of additional, but as integral elements. In the Gospel of John, it's totally different. All these paratexts are ancillary. You can have the Gospel of John without all this. It works perfectly well without it. But this is also a typical thing, I would say. This is what we expect in a Gospel manuscript. For the Albanian, it's all the more remarkable that the three parts were obviously bound together. You remember choir number 7 and 8 at the beginning of the lectionary part. Were obviously bound together as one codex before they were palimpsested. So we first had 2 or 3 manuscripts. They were bound together to be one codex, and then they were taken out again in order to be palimpsested, to be overwritten by Georgian. I have some open questions, which I will leave you with. One is, are the marginal or intercolumnar glosses later additions by a secunda manu or not? This cannot be established clearly from the images that we have. The pseudo-color images render everything in red, so the question whether something was a rubric in the proper sense before cannot really be answered. We will have to undertake some other analyses for this. I would say it's probably true that they were written in red ink and additional by an addition by a second hand. Probably true for the choir numbers, probably also true for the general header, which looks very different in its shape from the rest of the main text, and also probably yes for the colophon. For section numbers and apparatuses, possibly even a third hand, I cannot tell. But for all the others, I cannot really tell. Thank you very much for your attention. Uk e vaza, as you can see here in Albania. Thank you.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.